This is Dylan FM, the podcast that goes deep into the work and world of Bob Dylan. You're listening to an extended episode, available exclusively to FM Plus or premium subscribers, with your host, Craig Danieloff.
For 25 of our last 26 episodes, we talked about Time Out of Mind. In many of those shows, guests referred to Dylan's early 90s acoustic albums as the place where Bob got on the road that led him to Time Out of Mind. We're starting season two here at Dylan FM, and this season we're going to track that road. Like Ginger Rogers, we're going to do it backwards. So our first focus will be those two early 90s acoustic albums, Good As I've Been to You and World Gone Wrong. Then later this year, we'll revisit some of the 80s albums, specifically the ones that get all the bad press. And then finally, we'll end the year with a deep dive into Street Legal. We'll spend about 3 months on each, looking at them from as many angles as we can. We'll do that here on the podcast, on our blog and Substack, on social media, and perhaps even in some more live streaming events. One way to more fully appreciate Dylan is to sometimes zoom in real close and sometimes pull back and look at the big picture. In episode 2 of season 1, we offered one oversimplified way to look at Bob's entire career. In that, phase 1 is the insanely productive period of incredible success that lasted 16 years from 1961 to 1977. Phase 2 followed that with a long stretch of time where not everything he did was received with the same universal acclaim. This is 18 years between 1978 and 1996. And phase 3 is what happened from 1997 onward, which Jochen Marchorst proclaimed in the episode he was on last year, when Bob became an old master and once again enjoyed broad acclaim and endless accolades, a period which continues today. On this map of the world, we're spending this season in the middle phase. We're doing that in part because it explains everything that happened leading up to Time Out of Mind, but also because it broadly gets less attention, and it's a bit underappreciated having to stand in between those two phases of incredible success. Let's start in 1991. In some ways, I think this is where the campaign to restore Dylan's image began. I'd separate that from his artistic resurgence, of course, but I think the public image sets the stage for the artistic process that came later, so I think it's important. There are two key events in 1991, an otherwise not very eventful year in Dylan's life. The first was the Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award that he got in February, which, if it already hadn't existed, might have inspired the phrase, "You find out when you reach the top that you're on the bottom." Normally, getting a Lifetime Achievement Award from the most visible organization in your industry would be a milestone, an accomplishment, something to be proud of, and it would bolster a reputation. But serious Dylan fans know that Bob was just 50 years old, and it's an award that's usually given when you've made your contributions, but not much more is expected of you. And perhaps the record company pushed for it at that time because they didn't expect much more. Dylan gave a memorable performance and gave a memorable speech, but they were not crowd pleasers, and quite a few would say they were disasters. But let's look at it another way. For people who aren't serious Dylan fans, who don't know what he's saying or what he said that night, the social and institutional message of getting that award was in a way the start of a public rebuild. What we always hear about Dylan in the 80s was that he was broadly in the popular press and in the general music market forgotten and considered a has-been. But they don't give Lifetime Achievement Awards to forgotten has-beens. They give them to beloved and transformative people. So in the long march to create the Bob Dylan that he would become again, in the broad public eye, this was an important first step. And what happened the very next month? The bootleg series, Volume 1 through 3, was released. It's really too bad it didn't come out a month before the Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award. Imagine the buzz in the room if everyone had had a few weeks with that incredible box. That box followed the success of Biograph that was a few years before, and made it clear to the music community and music fans that Dylan certainly shouldn't be forgotten. A few months later, in June of 1992, Dylan went into Acme Studios in Chicago with David Bromberg with the intent of cutting an acoustic folk album. The Olaf files say that he spent 2 weeks in Chicago taping with Bromberg and his band. We think there were 26 songs recorded, primarily folk and blues materials, some of which include The Lady from Baltimore, Polly Vaughn, Casey Jones, Duncan and Brady, Catskill Serenade, Rise Again, World of Fools, and Nobody's Fault But Mine. Two of those had a 25-person gospel choir. But for whatever reason, Bob decided that this wasn't the album he wanted to put out. Two of the tracks later appeared on Telltale Signs. And almost immediately, Bob went home and started recording the songs that became Good As I've Been to You. There are 13 songs on that album, and it's generally believed that the You Belong to Me track, later released on the Natural Born Killers soundtrack, came from these sessions. Bob recorded all of this alone at home, with Debbie Gold as producer and Makaysha Ryan as engineer. About 5 years ago, Makaysha talked to a podcast called The Double Stop with host Brian Sword. The interview covered his entire career, including work with bands such as Guns N' Roses and Megadeth, but also dove deep into Makaysha's work on Good As I've Been to You and World Gone Wrong. We're going to listen to that now. Huge thanks to the Double Stop podcast and Brian Sword for capturing this interview and giving us permission to use it here. There's a link to the full interview in the show notes.
Now, in the early 90s, you also had the opportunity to work with Bob Dylan a couple times.
Yes, I did.
Now, tell me about that, because that sounds absolutely fascinating.
That was... I'll tell you what, Debbie Gold was my manager, and Debbie Gold, she passed away earlier this year, and it was very sad. She died of lung cancer, and I didn't find out. I actually talked to her a couple of weeks before she passed and communicated with her on Facebook, and she said she had pneumonia, and then I found out later she died of lung cancer. I was heartbroken because Debbie and I were like brother and sister. She drove me crazy. She was like a sister to me, but I adored her. I thought she was fantastic. And I came back from Australia working with a band called the Screaming Jets in Australia, and was taking a break. And my wife's grandma was dying, so we drove back to Kansas and to see grandma and have the kids see their great grandma. And, so while we're there and we're going to the hospital every day to see Debbie's grandma, my wife's grandma, Debbie Gold, my manager, calls me and she says, okay, you have to come back. I said, Debbie, I'm not coming back. My wife's grandma's dying. You know, we're waiting to see what's going on. She goes, no, you have to you don't understand. You have to come back. I said, no, I'm not coming. And she goes, well, you have to come back. It's a really big job. I said, tell me who it is. She goes, I can't. I said, well, if you're not going to tell me, I'm not coming back. And she goes, all right, it's Bob Dylan. Now, at that time, now I know this is weird, but at that time, I was not a Bob Dylan fan. I love Bob's songs, other people doing his songs, but I wasn't a huge Bob Dylan fan. And so I said, well, you know, this is a real big family time for me. You better give this to someone else. She starts screaming at me. She goes, what? Are you out of your mind? You're crazy. I'm like, well, Debbie, really, honestly, I'm here with my wife's grandma. And she goes, look, you got to come back. So I talk with my wife and she goes, it's only for a week. So I talk to my wife. She goes, well, if it's only for a week, go ahead and you can come back and get me. So I fly back to Los Angeles and I go and meet Bob and start working with him, record a couple of songs. And he says to Debbie, he says, I really like this guy. I want to make a whole record with him. It's like, oh, okay. So it ended up that did the whole record with him, and we worked for 3 months. He wouldn't let me go back to get my wife and kids for 3 months. And I would talk to Bob, please, let me go back, get my wife and kids. I'll be gone for a weekend. I'll come back. He goes, nope, no, I need you, Mikasia. You can't go. It's like, oh, please, Bob, please. He goes, nope, can't go. It's like, and finally, it wasn't until we finished mastering the record that he let me go. And so I came back, but it worked out great. I mean, it was that record, Good As I've Been to You, was the most fun record I ever made in my whole life. I had more fun making that record than any other time. Debbie Gold and I had a ball doing it. I think Bob had a ball doing it. He just had a lot of fun. It was an amazing experience. We did it in Bob's garage. And so I drove out to Malibu every day and went to Bob's garage and recorded this record in his garage. And it was just an amazing experience. It was just, and as a result of this, I think Bob knew I wasn't a fan because the first thing I said to him was, Bob, I've never owned one of your records. So which one would you recommend that I go get and listen to? And he looked at me like I had lobsters crawling out of my ears. And it's like, nobody ever says that to Bob Dylan, you know?
So, yeah, right.
So then Debbie busts in. She goes, go get Blood on the Track. So I went and got Blood on the Tracks and loved the record and just really gained an appreciation. Plus, we just had this really relaxed, it was me, Debbie Gold, and Bob Dylan in his studio, in his house. And he would, you know, take a break and he'd go into the house or he'd go outside and smoke a cigarette in the studio, which we did at that time. You know, nobody smokes in the control rooms anymore, but he would smoke in there and he was great. He taught me some of the greatest lessons ever in my life. It was just, he was the most intelligent guy I ever worked with. And as you can tell, I'm a huge fan of Bob. I think Bob is an awesome guy. I don't know how much you want me to tell you about that, but you know, there were some amazing things.
Take as much as I can get because it's brilliant.
Well, I'll tell you the one story that makes the biggest impression on me even to this day.
Sure.
And he would record. He'd do a song and he would record take after take after take after take of these songs. And these songs were other people's songs. So he was very, very vigilant about doing another person's song, doing it justice. So he'd do take after take after take after take. And, you know, he'd do it in every key imaginable, every tempo. He'd do it in every voice. He would try every different thing. So we're getting to towards the end of a reel of tape, and he says, hey, Mikasia, you have room for another take on there? I look at the tape and I'm going, you know, yeah, sure, Bob, we got another room for another take. And he goes, you sure you got room? I go, yeah, I'm sure. So I hit record and he cuts the tempo in half. So all of a sudden I'm going, I don't know if I have enough tape on here to record this. So I'm standing over the tape machine, sweat pouring off my brow, dripping onto the tape machine. I'm having to avoid it, hitting the tape. And he gets all the way to the last chorus, about halfway through the last chorus, and the tape falls off. So I get on the talk back and I go, Bob, I'm really sorry. I didn't know you were going to cut the tempo in half. I got everything but the last chorus, the last bit of the last chorus. He goes, oh, that's okay. I want to hear it. And I think that was pretty good. So I put it back up and rewind it and hit play. And we listened to the whole thing, whole song from beginning to end. And he looks at me and he kind of nods his head. And he goes, yeah, yeah. And he walks out into the studio and he starts working on a completely different song. So I put up a reel of tape and he starts working on this completely different song. And about an hour later, he goes, hey, Mikasia, you know that song where the tape ran out? I said, yeah. And he goes, could you put that up? I want to hear it again. And so I whipped the other tape off. I put the other tape on and I rewind it and we listened to the whole thing. And sure enough, and the tape falls off. Tape falls off and he nods his head. He goes, yeah. And he walks out into the studio and he, he starts working on another song, completely different song. So I put another reel of tape up and start working on that. And so we're working on that for about an hour. And about an hour later, he goes, hey, Makaysia, you know that song where the tape ran out? And I go, yes. He goes, could we listen to that again? Yeah, of course. So I whipped the other tape off, put that tape on. We listened to the whole song from beginning to end, and the tape falls off. And meanwhile, and I'm starting to go, oh, God, I'm such a jerk. And he was teaching me a lesson. The lesson he taught me was, don't you ever run out of tape on me. If you think that there's a possibility there's not enough tape, you put another fresh reel up. Because I don't really care how much the tape costs. All I care about is getting the take. And so I never ran out of tape on him ever again. And it was the greatest lesson I ever learned. I mean, he taught, he didn't yell. He didn't scream. He didn't embarrass me. He just had me listen to it over and over again. And till I got it, you know, I was like,
just to hear that sound of the tape ending.
Yeah. No kidding.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was the way he would teach me stuff that way. And it was an amazing way to be taught. And I really loved it. And I love him. I thought he was awesome. So,
and I guess the experience was so good that he brought you back again then for the next one.
Yes, he did. He brought me back for World Gone Wrong. And World Gone Wrong actually is a fantastic record. Good As I've Been to You is not as good a record as World Gone Wrong. And the bottom line is, really the honest truth is, Bob did an awesome job on everything he did. It was me. I just wasn't a good enough engineer to make that the kind of record he wanted to make. He wanted to make a really rough, raw sounding record, and I didn't know how to do that and feel good about it. And so I didn't do it. And I feel really bad about that. I regret that to this day. Just because I was still inexperienced, to the point where I didn't trust myself, didn't really know how to do that. I would know now if he called me tomorrow and asked me to make a record like he wanted to make with those two records I worked on, I'd know exactly how to do it. You know, I'd know exactly what I want to do and what he would want to do. And I feel very confident about it, but I wasn't confident about it back then at all. And so, but I'm really thankful that record did come out. World Gone Wrong came out as good as it did. It actually won a Grammy, the best folk album of the year. And those songs were amazing songs, incredible. And Bob's performances were just breathtaking. It was like having him give me a concert every day for like 3 months, you know, sing just for me and just for Debbie Gold, you know. So it was incredible, you know, to have that kind of relationship for that small amount of period of time was pretty breathtaking. And I've talked with other people who've had experiences with Bob and produced stuff for Bob, and they've looked at me like, what are you talking about? Bob never does that. You know, he never takes 20 takes of a song. He gives you one, maybe two takes, and that's it. And he's like, and you're done. And it's like, no, with Bob, when I worked with Bob, he did like, there was one song we did 60 takes of one song before he finally got it right. Yeah, it was amazing. And so he was just so dedicated to it. And his work ethic is incredible. I mean, he would start at 1 o'clock every morning and he would work solid till 1 o'clock. He would take a dinner break, but then we'd work till 1 o'clock every evening. And, It was just amazing. I mean, his work ethic was incredible, and what he did was, I really got it. I really understood. I don't know if I understood Bob. I don't know who does, but I got it. I got where he's coming from and why he's considered such a great guy and why he's such a great artist and a great performer and a great writer. And so, it was pretty awesome. And Debbie Gold was the one. Debbie and he were friends for years. She worked for him for years, and she was the one that got me that gig. So I will always be thankful to Deb for that. So
And now he's won the Nobel Prize.
How many people can say that? A guy that they worked with, that they recorded a record with, is a Nobel Prize laureate. So, Nobel laureate. You know, there aren't too many people who can say that. So.
It's always fun to hear from someone who worked directly with Bob. And I think the clarity we get here about the amount of Good As I've Been to You outtakes is incredible. 60 takes. Wonder which song that was. If we look at Dylan's schedule that year, there aren't any three-month breaks where this could have taken place. There's a month from mid-July to mid-August, and then a few weeks of touring, followed by another 3 weeks free, starting in mid-September. So that's likely when all this happened. For context, the 30th anniversary concert happened just after, in mid-October, and Good As I've Been to You was released at the end of October in 1992. 7 months later, in May 1993, with just a six-week break in between a year of nearly constant touring, Dylan called Mikesha back to the house, and they did the recording for World Gone Wrong. That album came out in late October 1993, almost a year after Good As I've Been to You. We're going to talk about those years, those albums, the songs on them, and look at it from a whole bunch of points of view with some great guests over the next few episodes. Before we talk, however, in 2023 about these albums, I wanted to look back and see what reviewers thought of them at the time they came out. Today, I'm going to read some reviews from Good As I've Been to You, and we'll look at the reviews for World Gone Wrong on another episode. Coincidentally, one of our guests from last season wrote one of these reviews. I found this because I was rereading the Good As I've Been to You chapter in Michael Gray's Song and Dance Man, and in there he quotes from John Wesley Harding's 1992 review in Stereophile. Well, that's Wesley Stace, who was on episode 7 last year, where he shared all kinds of great thoughts and stories about Time Out of Mind. If you missed that episode, you'll want to go back and catch it. Wes wrote the liner notes for the Rolling Thunder Review Live 75 box set and still makes great albums, as well as all those he did as John Wesley Harding. The review has long been out of print, at least as far as I could find. It wasn't online anywhere. But with Wes's permission, we're republishing it today in full for our premium members. It's up on our blog and Substack. Here's a little bit of that review. On Good As I've Been to You, we hear Dylan as he is now, playing material that is worth communicating. The guitar is beautiful throughout, played with a devil-may-care flourish that speaks fun out loud. He screws up the riff at the end of Step It Up and Go, so he goes through the whole sequence again, just for the hell of it. It's the kind of performer's pride that I thought Dylan had long since given up, and it makes good listening. That's Wesley Stace from Stereophile in 1992. Grill Marcus also took notice of Good As I've Been to You. Here's what he wrote in Real Life Top 10 in February of 1993. Other people's songs, but these songs are as much Dylan's as anyone else's. He sings them with an authority equal to that he brought to Blind Lemon Jefferson's See That My Grave Is Kept Clean in 1962. Dylan inhabiting the first-person narratives as if he's lived them twice. It's only after a time, when the melancholy and bitterness seems too great for one voice, that you hear them as history, as more than one man's plight. That was Grill Marcus from Real Life Top 10. In Entertainment Weekly, Billy Altman wrote, "You could brand Dylan either enormously foolish or rather courageous for releasing an album featuring such decomposed folk fare as Jim Jones, a sea shanty about a British galley slave, and Diamond Joe, a Texas prairie tale of cowpunchers and rounders. Not to mention such golden moldies as Black Jack Davy, Sitting on Top of the World, and, don't laugh, Froggy Went A-Courtin'." I say courageous, for the cumulative effect of this album is to remind us, in these divisive times, that we are the product of countless cultures and viewpoints. Those cultures and viewpoints survive through songs and stories passed from one generation to another, which is precisely what Bob Dylan, without ceremony or superstar ego, is doing here. Somebody Throw That Minstrel Boy a Coin. That was Billy Altman from Entertainment Weekly. On the AllMusic review, Stephen Thomas Erlewine writes, "Yes, this could be seen as a rather unassuming record, but that's what's special about it. In 1992, not even folk singers were working this material, but Dylan did. Reviving folk and rock's ties to the past at an unexpected time and with unexpectedly strong results. A minor high point in his catalog." In Rolling Stone, David Wilde wrote, "In its stripped-down intensity, Good As I've Been to You recalls the mid-show acoustic segments that in recent years have been a consistent highlight of Dylan's never-ending tour. Even more than that, the album's intimate, almost offhand approach suggests what it would be like to sit backstage with his Bobness while he runs through a set of his sometimes favorite old songs. This is passionate, at times almost ragged piece of work that seems to have been recorded rather than produced in any conventional sense. This fascinating exploration of musical roots is more than a diversion for musicologists. Good As I've Been to You shows that sometimes one can look back and find something that's both timeless and relevant. It also proves, once again, that Dylan can still be every bit as good as he's been to us in the past, which is, of course, as good as it gets." That was David Wilde from Rolling Stone. Everyone gets to write a review, and this is probably not contemporaneous, but this was from a website called Plugged In with a group called Focus on the Family that warns parents as to what's good and not good for their children. "A scoundrel named Blackjack Davy steals a 16-year-old bride who eagerly declares, 'I'll forsake my house and home, I'll forsake my baby, I'll forsake my husband too for the love of Blackjack Davy.' Little Maggie turns to alcohol as a temporary solution to her relational troubles. Two men violently beat a pair of army recruiters after being verbally threatened in Arthur McBride. On Frankie and Albert, the man's two-timing leads his woman to shoot him dead in a fit of passion after she goes drinking in the corner saloon. The singer, relegated to a chain gang, appears to be threatening the woman in his life on 'You're Gonna Quit Me. The day you quit me, baby, that's the day you'll die.' So, put the kids away." And lastly, I want to read something from one of my favorite, maybe the all-time greatest Dylan writer, at least in my opinion, Paul Williams from Crawdaddy. Here's from a review that is reprinted in his Watching the River Flow book. "Good As I've Been to You is Bob Dylan's 40th album, including the two with the Traveling Wilburys. It's also, remarkably, the first solo acoustic album he's made in 28 years. Why so long? Probably because he just didn't want to do what people wanted him to do. And he hasn't. He's found a new way instead. New old way. He's playing acoustic guitar and harmonica, and he's singing songs he never wrote. An album of covers, not goofy and detached like Self-Portrait, or quirky and wildly uneven like Down in the Groove, but affectionate, modest, intimate, and committed. In a different way from Blood on the Tracks, in a different way from the Basement Tapes, it is an intimate album. Indeed, it may be the most intimate album Bob Dylan has ever recorded. The range of source material is fascinating and reveals a side of Dylan few people are aware of. He is, in his own way, a song scholar, and throughout his career, has learned many more songs than he has ever performed publicly. He likes oddball sources, though he's not a show-off about it. He doesn't hesitate to include a very familiar song like Frankie and Albert, Blackjack Davy, Froggy Went A-Courtin', alongside more unusual choices. He's not gone out of his way to rework these songs. Rather, each is to some extent a tribute to the source he learned it from. It comes out sounding similar to or different from that source depending on Dylan's mood as he sings it, and what feels good to his fingers or his voice, what key he's comfortable playing in, and so forth." Every song on this album has its own voice, each unique creation and not for show, but for the specific purpose of honoring and getting across the song. Each performance full of respect for history and for the human feeling and experience that is back of that history. Those were written by Paul Williams from his review of Good As I've Been to You, as most recently published in his book called Watching the River Flow. These are clearly powerful reviews, and this is just a sample. It shows that what Dylan did in his garage was significant and perhaps tells us something about how that album and the next one put in the base that he could build from. We'll talk a lot more about the contents of these albums and Dylan's world in these years in the coming episode. I'd like to end with a bit of a homework assignment. Put Good As I've Been to You and World Gone Wrong back into rotation. Give them a few listens over the next week or so. Get familiar again if they've slipped out of your mind, so you can enjoy and even participate in our upcoming shows. I've always loved these albums and have had them on heavy rotation for a few weeks now. I got new vinyl and other versions and really just couldn't enjoy these records any more than I do. So I'm looking forward to the conversations and the discovery ahead.
Thanks for listening. This show is a part of the FM Podcast Network. Visit us at fmpods.com.